Amazing how small it is in Trump.
You ready? House Committee on Revenue will come to order for March 26, 2009. Committee, we have quite an agenda this morning. We're going to open the public hearing on House Bill 3082. And we'll hear from Chris and then from Director Harchenko.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3082 is a bill that authorizes state agencies, boards, and commissions that issue occupational or professional licenses to require the licensees to be in compliance with Oregon tax laws as a condition of issuance or renewal of those licenses. The bill, as drafted, pertains to personal income taxes and corporate income and excise taxes, and it allows the Department of Revenue to disclose to these agencies or boards whether or not the potential licensee is in compliance, and it defines compliance in the bill, and it essentially has to do with whether or not the taxpayer has timely filed returns or as basically in communication with the Department of Revenue about their tax status if need be. The bill, you saw this in 2007. It was a piece of House Bill 2592 that actually passed out of the House. It got pulled on the Senate side last session. And the bill is drafted. You have it in front of you, and we are soon to be getting some Dash 2 amendments.
Ah, okay. And we have a Dash 1. Is that?
The Dash 1, I think we want to set aside.
Okay. All right. Director Harchenko. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Director Elizabeth Harchenko, Director of your Department of Revenue. I just wanted to tell you a story. I told this story to Representative Reed as we were talking about actually our compliance report that we shared with you at the end of January. As you recall, one of the recommendations that we had in the report was to look for ways to work with licensing boards to assure compliance by people or entities that must receive permission from state government in order to carry on a trade or a business, and to look for some partners among that the body of agencies, and to develop a pilot and then come back in 2011 with information. So this bill would be very consistent with that. But now to the story. When I was first appointed 12 years ago, I had occasion to go to a meeting with the Internal Revenue Service in their Seattle District Office for what was then called the Pacific Northwest Region and included the state of Hawaii. The director from Hawaii attended the meeting and also brought the IRS liaison from his area. And they mentioned that they had just been working with the Hawaii Board of Real Estate Licensing on a project related to tax compliance. And the board had concluded that it was important for their licensees to be in compliance with both federal and state of Hawaii tax law in order to be licensed. And so they started with a public information campaign about a year ahead of the point in time when the Board of Real Estate was going to impose that requirement on their licensees, and just basically communicated with people that when their licenses came up for renewal, that they would be expected to show that they were in tax compliance. The director chuckled a little bit and said to me, "You won't believe how many returns we got in that year from people who were in the real estate business." And they were very, very pleased with the result that they had hoped to get, which was compliance by people who hadn't been. So we've been talking about this for a long time, I think. We've tried in the department to gather information from some licensing agencies over the years about compliance rates. There are challenges that that boards have. Some of them are very small and have few resources. Others are large and have people that that register not only in their individual names but in assumed business names or through limited liability entities. But we were going to work this biennium on trying to find some representative and willing partners to test this idea in Oregon, see whether it would be a useful one, and then come back. So the bill would provide the vehicle for that to happen. And I'd be happy to answer any questions. I guess I would like to say it is voluntary for the agencies, but if there's an expectation that we do this work, or as you consider amendments, whether there's any requirement, we are going to need resources. As Representative Smith mentioned to you before the hearing started, we're in Ways and Means right now, and considering budget reductions. So it would be nice to have a conversation between the two ends of the building about what's the work that we need to do for you and what the resources are that we need. So we'll continue to let them know we've got this legislation pending.
Thank you. Questions? Yes, Representative Berger.
Maybe not a question so much as a comment. Your story is very telling, and I particularly like the mention that you can't just spring this on people. You have to do some outreach that's cogent and understandable, and otherwise the pushback is going to be enormous, and I'm appreciative that you start with that story, because we need to hear the pitfalls before we wade into these waters. Thank you.
Senator Bentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director, do you have an idea of how many folks might be affected by this? How many folks we're actually talking about in this class? Commissioners, boards, professions.
There we go. Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, I don't know the number of people who have licenses that are issued for trades or occupations by the state of Oregon. I know it's a wide range. Construction contractors has tens of thousands, down to some that have maybe 1,000 or 1,200, so it's quite a range. We have many, many trades and professions that are licensed in this state. So I imagine your staff probably can help you with that.
The smallest one is probably 20.
Yeah. So there's just a huge range, and that is one of the things that makes it important for us to do a proof of concept or a pilot, is to figure out how to make this seamless and transparent, not have it impose an incredible burden on either the licensing board or the licensee if an agency says, we really feel you need to show that you're in compliance. We need to be able to come up with that information quickly and effectively so that we don't hang up a licensing process for someone who is, in fact, in compliance. So that's why we appreciate the enabling approach, so that we can look for a willing partner, work through the process, figure out how to deal with the inevitable bumps in it before moving it out in a big way.
I have a follow-up, I guess. The prompt that suggests that folks that are licensed by the state of Oregon should have to prove that they're in tax compliance is just that they're licensed, and therefore they have a higher obligation to make sure they are in tax compliance? Or is that the justification for this device, as opposed to any other person that's not licensed?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, that's really probably the policy issue that perhaps Representative Reed could address as the sponsor. We've heard from other states that they're starting to use this as a tool. We did talk in the compliance report about the fact that that the less visible the income sources and the fewer the third-party reporting mechanisms, the greater the risk of noncompliance, and people who are licensed to engage in a trade or a business often are in business for themselves. So there is an association between compliance levels and people that are in business for themselves. I realize that some of the folks that are licensed by the boards are employed by others, but it's one tool in the kit that we're hearing about across the country that states are using and finding to be effective.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much. We appreciate your being here this morning. Good luck with Ways and Means.
Thank you, sir.
How well we do on this end of the building may depend on how well you do on that end.
Yes, that's true.
Thank you. Donna Maddox, Jody Weiser. Oh, Representative Reed, did you want to?
I can join them, perhaps.
Oh, okay, fine. Let's wait for Representative Reed, and we'll let him kick off.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Tobias Reed. There's something under my feet here, so I apologize for that. I'm state representative from District 27, Beaverton, Southwest Portland, parts of unincorporated Washington and Multnomah counties. The director mentioned this should look familiar to those of you who were here last session. It passed the House and went to the Senate and didn't succeed in the Senate, and so we're back. But I think as a, with the intent of clarifying and addressing some of the concerns that were expressed in 2007, the bulk of that, I think, was a concern at some risk of putting words in others' mouths, at least what I understood was some concern that this process might prevent people from practicing needed professions and continuing in their work. And I want to clarify and make very clear that that is not the intent. Nothing that's in this approach would prevent anyone from making use of any appeals processes, of any disputes they might have with the Department of Revenue. That all goes on as normal. This is, I think, a reasonable way to ensure or promote tax compliance. I think it's a responsible way as a pilot project to figure out how that works with hopefully a representative sample of the various licensing agencies that do this sort of thing. And I think to Representative Benz's question, there is a relationship between those who get licenses. We are, as a state, saying something about the competence of this person to engage in whatever their profession is. So I think there is a higher responsibility for that person to pay the taxes they owe. No one who is following the law has anything to fear from this process. One other quick point about a reason to support this. You might also look at this as an efficiency measure. It's going to cost the Department of Revenue less if there is a reason for the person, the taxpayer, and a licensee to be communicating with the Department of Revenue. Just like the other component of the bill that this was in last time, that piece about the out-of-state real estate transactions, when there's a prompted communication between the licensee and the department, we'll be spending less resources pursuing those folks. The last point is why this matters. Jody probably has more recent data, but the tax gap is pretty important. None of this committee needs to be reminded of what that means, but those who might be watching or listening elsewhere, that's the difference between what is owed in taxes and what is paid in taxes. The last study that I looked at was from the Brookings Institution that suggests that it might be as much as 20%. I don't have any particular data on whether Oregonians are more or less honest than the rest of the country. Hopefully they're a bit more. But even if it's something less than that, that's a significant amount. And in these times, as our budgets really are struggling, that's good resource. So I appreciate your willingness to hear the bill and commend it to your support. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any questions for Representative Reed? Yes, Representative Berger.
Thank you, Representative Reed, and I appreciate this discussion. I am incredibly aware of how many people are unemployed out there. They need jobs today, not after a bureaucracy has charged through all the things that bureaucracies go through. On a personal note, I have had a lot of contact with the insurance division in the time it takes them to get insurance agents licensed while they are sitting there being paid and cannot do their job. So I have real serious reservations, and I'm just putting this out here for you ahead of time, on in a time when people need jobs and need to be working, putting any barriers between somebody who needs a job and their ability to do that job. And I'm very aware of the testimony we just heard from the director about the resources she'd need in order to do this in a timely fashion. So I'm just kind of signaling here that I have real problems. problems with this concept along, considering our current status of unemployment.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, I appreciate that, and I think that's a very reasonable concern. I think part of the response to that would be the hope that we do this in a pilot program so that it could respond to that and we could test the best mechanisms to make it an efficient and quick process. I think that's a reasonable concern.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Go ahead. Yes.
Good morning, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. My name is Donna Maddox. I'm the attorney in charge of the organized crime section at the Oregon Department of Justice. My section has some authority for dealing with tax crimes in the state. In 2004, I was one of two attorneys assigned to our tobacco compliance task force, working with the Department of Revenue to enforce tobacco tax crimes. More recently, my section has worked with the Department of Revenue to do a major income tax-related case. Our experience has been all our defendants in all of our cases are business individuals licensed on a variety of levels by the state who are committing a variety of tax crimes. These folks don't just cheat in one area, they cheat in every area. We have found that in dealing with them, it has been amazing to see the variety of licenses that folks are able to get because the agencies do not talk to each other with respect to compliance with tax laws. It has been interesting in the process of pursuing those cases and talking to witnesses and other people involved. Typically, competing businesses who say to us, I cannot compete against the guy down the street who can undercut my ability to, you know, charge a fair rate for my product or to get a good cost for the services I'm providing because he can always undercut me because he's not paying his taxes. I think there is an assumption in the business community that the state does talk amongst itself. And that folks can only get licenses if they are in compliance, but that has not been the case. I will say that I work on a variety of state, local, and federal groups that do work relative to financial crimes all across the state, IRS, FBI, U.S. Attorney's Office, and, again, folks all over at a state and local level. We find time and time again that it's so surprising for us that we have so many folks who are operating in Oregon completely under the radar and committing financial crimes because they don't have the ability to be blocked from getting business licenses because of chronic noncompliance with tax laws. It has been a very interesting and eye-opening piece for me the last few years working in this area. Representative Berger made the comment earlier about, you know, pushback from the community. And again, I will say that the business folks that we have talked to really have been looking to the state to protect them from folks who are not paying. So it's been on an enforcement end, it's been a very interesting issue to see both from the law enforcement side and from the business folks who are out there, the effect of not having the ability to communicate between these agencies. I think we will have less folks to do enforcement actions against if we are given the opportunity to do so, if we have the ability to talk on the front end.
Thank you.
For the record, I'm Jody Weiser with Tax Fairness Oregon. Actually, I realized how old I was just this morning because this bill has been before you since 2005. It was Senate Bill 480 then. But Chris wasn't here yet, and neither was Tobias when we attempted to move the same kind of provision through. I'm delighted to see it come forward now. And it actually has been tested in the past because there was one agency that worked with the department several years ago to try to do this, and every employee that gets hired at the Department of Revenue has to be tax compliant and remain tax compliant. They know how to do it with that workforce. So I think that they've got the processes in place, and you'll see nice action on this as it moves forward. We're really delighted that Representative Reed brought it forward this year. The tax gap that the Department of Revenue recognizes is $1.2 billion a year. We collect about $5 billion a year from taxpayers, so that means we could have $6.2 billion before us each year were taxpayers paying their taxes honestly. And if I may, because I'd like to get to Ways and Means, can I speak to the next bill as well?
No.
Okay.
I'm sorry, it's not open.
Okay.
Are there questions for this panel?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Brune.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you. First of all, a comment, then a question. First of all, I want to acknowledge Don is also a Tualatin City Councilor, so thank you for your service for being here. And this is a question for either for Don or Representative Reed. Your sense of the efficacy of this in other states that are doing this and how they've managed this and truly, you know, I mean, addressing both the collection results as well as the fear that Representative Berger raised and it, as far as any sort of inhibitor, if you will, to jobs or job creation. Is there any, and Don, is there any sense of that with some of your colleagues in other states?
Mr. Chair, Representative Brune, my information is simply anecdotal along the lines of the stories that the director mentioned, that there have been good results. I don't have specific statistical information, but everything I've read and heard suggests that once people get used to this, that it works pretty well.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and Representative Brune, I would say that I have been involved in some national tax groups working from the tobacco tax end. What we have found, what happened in tobacco tax land in Oregon, and I think stretches to all other tax compliance areas, when people understand that the ability to look and to communicate is out there, it increases the voluntary compliance that the director was talking about. So even in the absence of enforcement, the idea that the ability is out there increases voluntary compliance on the front end.
Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just so I understand, and anyone can answer this question, the difference between this device and just hiring more auditors to focus, let's say, on professionals that are licensed is exactly what? Is it that the licensing agency is going to be asked to say these people are in compliance? Because when I hear that concept of exchanging data, it looks as though there will be a burden placed upon the licensing agency so that it could in turn say to the Department of Revenue, these folks are in compliance. I know that the pilot project is designed to do this, but I'm just trying to get at the exact difference between hiring more auditors on the one hand and having them look at professionals as opposed to this device.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, thanks. It's an excellent question. I think one of the primary differences is the deterrent effect that has been mentioned already, that if an applicant or a licensee knows that that this question will be asked, that this issue will be probed in the process of their application, they're more likely to take care of things on the front end. I would definitely support investing in more auditors as well, but I think this is perhaps a more efficient mechanism of getting at the same goal.
Hello, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
So the concept is the degree of inquiry that we impose upon the licensing agency would be of importance. And again, the pilot project would get at that, because asking would be, of course, one level, demanding they bring in a copy of their tax return another, demanding that the Department of Revenue say they have paid would be another. I mean, there's all these levels.
That's right. And Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, I think the intent is to answer a series of yes-no questions. Has the applicant filed a return? Is the applicant essentially, I'm not reading the precise language, but is the applicant in communication with the Department of Revenue? That gets at if there are ongoing disputes or appeals or that sort of thing. But are they talking to each other is the essential intent.
Please.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, if I could just add to that, the key piece for us has always been disclosure issues with the Department of Revenue, and the reality is that getting access to any tax information is relatively impossible for law enforcement or anyone else in the state because of the protections that are afforded that information. This bill, as I read it, would allow those licensing agencies to make inquiry and then would allow Department of Revenue to actually respond, which they had traditionally not even been able to respond in even that limited fashion.
Thank you. Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I look at the original bill, Section 2, little a, lines 20 and 22, and then I compare them to the amendments in the dash 2, it looks like the language that's causing me some concern has been changed in the amendment. However, I'll read what I'm talking about here, has failed to timely file returns with respect to taxes imposed by ORS numbers, and it's for the 3 years immediately preceding the year for which a tax return was required to be filed. And then I move over to the dash 2 amendments, and it says, talks about personal income tax laws of the state. So to get to my question, my concern when I originally read this language, and then it's still fairly vague for me in the dash twos. First of all, forgive my ignorance on this, but I'm one of those people, I won't even wait till the 15th to mail my returns. Our CPA is our favorite person in the whole wide world, and I'm very fearful, quite frankly. So we do all those right things with our taxes, so I don't even know what it looks like if you drop it in the box on the 16th. And what my concern is, somebody applying for their license had this crisis at the end, which is why we file our returns earlier, can't get them in the box on time, whoops, 2 or 3 years earlier, and now their livelihood is in jeopardy. So I guess if you could rectify the language here for me and address that issue. Because this isn't the person who has intentionally defrauded the Department of Revenue.
And I think that may lead you into a discussion of the Dash 2 amendments.
It might well, and it also, Mr. Chair, Representative Springer, might give us an opportunity to invite Deborah up, who has helped us with the mechanics of that and might better be able to speak to the sequence. Because I think you're absolutely right. Our intent is not to go after someone who made an honest mistake. And again, if they're in communication with the Department of Revenue, I think that would constitute compliance for our intent. So. If that's okay, we can invite Deborah up.
Well, it would be true, wouldn't it, if you mailed your tax return late and the department assessed a penalty of some kind because you were late, you paid the penalty, you would then be in compliance, wouldn't you,
Mr. Chair, under
the Dash 2s?
Mr. Chair, I think that's absolutely right.
Okay. Does that answer the question?
To
some extent. What is the... I seriously don't know. What does that process look like? I mean, does the Department of Revenue get on the phone 2 days later and call you? I'm sure not. So is this a protracted event where you're in limbo for 6 months?
Why don't we do this? Let's finish asking questions of this panel, and then we'll ask Deborah to try to answer some of these mechanical questions, if that's okay with you.
I think that's a great idea, Mr. Chair. I think they're very good questions. I'm just nervous about answering for
them. Right. No, I completely agree. Are there other questions for this panel? And we'll save the mechanically how the thing works for someone from the department. I have just a comment, I guess. I was looking at this thing and thinking, gee, here we are telling the licensing board that they can do this if they want to. Why would they ever want to? And I think, Ms. Maddox gave me the answer to that, and that is that the vast majority of licensees are honest, they pay their taxes, they want to do things correctly, and they get and they have a competitive disadvantage with those who don't. My suspicion at that point is that there are probably a number of boards, once they understood what this bill did, that would probably be happy to comply if they could figure out a way to do it. And I appreciate that. Anything else for this panel? Why don't we ask this panel to step down then?
Thank you.
And perhaps Deborah, you could come forward and deal with some of these mechanical questions. How this bill would work if with the kinds of issues that Representative Springer raises, and there may be others.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning. For the record, Deborah Buchanan with the Department of Revenue. I will start with that question. The mechanics of a person who is required to file a return, and I appreciate the reminder my return is due as well, and I will get that in by April 15th. Filing my return April 15th does mean that I am then in compliance with the tax laws. If I have an issue and I can't get that in on time and I don't have an approved extension of time to file the return, then until I do get that in, I'm not in compliance. As to the language in the amendment and the bill about the 3 years immediately preceding, once that return does come in, even if it is late, as the chair said, I would be in compliance. So I think what we're looking for with this language is a pattern of behavior, someone who fails to file the returns at all for the 3 preceding years. And we would look at that and say that person definitely is not in compliance. So there would be an incentive for them to get those returns in. If we look at the 3 preceding years and every year they're a year late in filing, but they eventually do file, once they have filed the returns, they are in compliance. So we would not look at the fact that they have a pattern, but once they are in compliance, they would be fine.
Okay. Representative Berger?
Yeah, thank you, Deborah. What if they file and there's dispute on their filing and you're in a sort of a close to courts dispute? Would that be compliance or noncompliance under this language?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, I believe the language in the amendment, lines 12 through 15, are intended to address that. The short answer is if you have filed but there's a dispute and you still have appeal rights, you're in compliance. We would not say someone who has exercised their appeal rights but has unpaid tax is out of compliance. So the appeal rights have expired. Let's assume that we adjust the return in processing. We send out a billing for additional tax. The person has 30 days to write back to the department and say, I object to your bill. If they don't do that within 30 days, they have 90 days to appeal to the tax court. During that time, they are in compliance, even though the tax is unpaid. If they don't contact the department and challenge the tax, and they don't appeal it within the 90 days, then the tax is assessed. That means it becomes final. If they still don't pay it, and they don't contact us about setting up a payment plan, then we would look at this and say that person is not in compliance with the tax laws. So if the appeal period is open and there's unpaid tax, they're still in compliance. Once that appeal period expires, if they don't pay within a certain period of time, they don't contact us and set up a payment plan, then we're looking at that to say they're out of compliance. If they set up a payment plan with us, and then 3 months later or 6 months later, they fall out of the payment plan and they're not making those payments as agreed, then they would also be out of compliance with the tax laws.
I admit to not have read all the bill and tried to figure it all out, so let's get some things on the record here. Who would write the rules around this three-year thing, the would it be the Department of Revenue that would write the rules?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, thank you for that question. Yes, I see the department as writing the rules, and I see the department as the one responsible for determining compliance. And there's been discussion about what information is disclosed or what is exchanged. It seems to me that there would be ways to set this up so that information actually doesn't have to go to a licensing agency, that they don't receive tax return information. For example, I'm licensed under the Board of Accountancy, even though I have an inactive license now. I can go to their website, search on my name, and find the information about my license when it expires. One way we might be able to make this work is the licensing board or agency sends us a list of people whose licenses expire in the next 2 or 3 months. We run that data. We do a match. We can say all of these people are in compliance. We send that list back to the licensing board. They don't even have to ask those people when they send out their renewal application whether they're in compliance or not, because they know they are. We told them. Or we might be able to set it up with a secure website where we could go into that website and put a check mark, yes, they're compliant. And then when the licensing agency sends out its application, they see they're compliant. That could be invisible to the applicant. So there are a number of ways that we might be able to do this.
Follow up, Mr. Chair, if you'll indulge me. Deborah, I actually have two questions, Mr. Chair. This would only be upon application or renewal. Is there any, you're in the middle of your realty, pick a realtor, and you're working away, and all of a sudden they contact you and say, by the way, your license is being pulled because the Department of Revenue just informed us you didn't make a deadline. Is that contemplated in this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, that's not contemplated in this, but current law provides us with the authority to do exactly that. If we've been working with someone on getting them in compliance with the tax system and they have consistently refused and we have not been able to collect the tax, the law currently allows us to ask for license suspension to begin with that licensing agency. So that's available under current law.
So we already have the ability to control licensing of folks who wouldn't be in compliance. Working from the other end, those, instead of assuming, if you will, actually working directly with those who we know are not in compliance, rather than trying to cast a big net on folks who really are probably trying to comply with all tax laws.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, that process is very much an after-the-fact, at the end of all collection efforts to get that person into compliance, kind of a last-ditch effort to collect the tax and make sure that they're paying. This is more at the front end to say, in order to get a license or to renew a license in this state, you need to show that you are in compliance with the tax laws, or there needs to be an indication that you are in compliance with the tax laws. So that could be the department saying, yes, they are in compliance. So it works at both ends of the spectrum.
One more question. So you're unemployed, you apply for a real estate license, and I'm just picking real estate out of the hat. You've invested in all the education and training. You are now taking the test. You've passed the test. And back comes the real estate agency. You did everything right. Go talks to the tax people because we can't license you. Okay? Is that the way it would work? In other words, they're caught in this, I've invested all this down the line to get this licensing, and now at the end I'm informed that I can't get my license, didn't know going in, didn't know I was out of compliance. I really worry. People are looking for jobs, and I am really worried that we are putting another barrier between people and jobs in this state. I'm just harping on this.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, I appreciate the comments, and I would think that what would happen is when we identify the agencies that we want to work with and those that want to work with us, that information will be prominent and visible and communicated very early in that process, so you don't put forth all that effort and all that expense and get to the end and find out, whoops, I need to file tax returns and I can't do that. Tell them at the very front when they're first starting that process that, by the way, in order to get a license in this state, you need to show you're in compliance with the tax laws.
Thank you.
Representative Springer, and then Representative Riley, and then Representative Call.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Know that this is a great concept. As I said, we pay our taxes. I think others should pay their taxes. What concerns me about this bill and Representative Reed and I talked about this probably a month ago, is the details. It's all about the details. And I've read through this, the bill and the amendments. Maybe I've just missed it, and maybe it was in testimony, I'm not sure, but my concern is that the only piece of information they can access is compliant or not compliant, and not have access. Licensing boards not have access to the reasons why, because I think there's a reason it's hard to get tax information. That's very private information. So talk to me a little bit about that. I want to make sure, and it does concern me a little bit if we're leaving that piece to the rulemaking, that they can only access compliant or non-compliant information.
Mr. Chair, Representative Springer, you're absolutely right that we have very strict standards and very strict laws around disclosure of tax information. If we have willful disclosure of tax information is a Class C felony, subject to a year in jail, $100,000 fine. So it's very something we take very seriously. My understanding of this proposal is that the department would not necessarily be required to share tax return information with the licensing agencies. That what is needed is we state that they are or are not in compliance with the tax laws. And we would look at the information we have in our system and then tell the licensing agency, yes, the person is in compliance with the tax laws. If we look at it and we see that they should have filed a return for 2 years ago, we've contacted them, not been able to get the return in, and they still have asked for the license, we would respond that they're not in compliance with the tax laws. And then my assumption would be the licensing agency would tell the person, well, you need to check with the Department of Revenue and find out what the problem is here, because we can't issue the license.
Representative Springer, I would note the lines 14 through 17 of the bill say what it is the Department of Revenue can do, and the way I read it is they can tell the board or commission whether an individual or corporation is in compliance. It doesn't say they can release any other information.
Right.
But you have another question. Go ahead.
No, I think that addresses it. I guess I want to be very clear, make a comment, be very clear. Mm-hmm. That right there is, I think, a crucial element. And you did reference it concerning a little bit, not necessarily be required. And I think that's a huge, huge issue in this bill.
Representative Reed, is it on this?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
It is.
Yeah,
I just
please.
Wanted to make clear that as one of the sponsors here, that is certainly my intent, that it would be a series of binary yes-no questions. I don't have any interest in making greater information available. It would be very simple in my mind.
You just brought up a point for me, and I know I'm hounding this, but I think this is just a really big deal. You said a series of yes-no questions. I would anticipate one question. Are they in compliance, yes or no?
May I clarify? That's absolutely
okay.
Right. I meant that in order to answer the single yes-no question to the licensing agency, the department would look at a series of yes-no questions, being have they filed in the last 3 years,
okay.
Or that kind of stuff,
okay.
To get to the single question back to the licensing agency.
Yeah, Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Deborah, you're a licensee in an accountancy board. I have a realty license. And I know that at least in my licensing, I could go online to the licensing agent or I could contact the licensing agent and they would give me all the rules. Here's what you have to do to get your license. Come see us when you've got this done. And if that said somewhere in there, make sure your taxes are you're in compliance. If you think you may not be, talk with revenue. I think that's certainly within the capability of most licensing agents in the state, and I think that would go a long way to Representative Berger's issue of getting right down to the end and saying, oh, whoops, I haven't done this. Everyone who goes for a license, in my experience, knows before they go in, you know, what the requirements are. And there's a series of requirements for every license. If that's one of the known requirements, I think that settles that. Does that make sense to you?
Mr. Chair, Representative Riley, yes. And I in working with whichever agencies or boards want to work with us, we work with them to make sure that information is communicated very early in the process on their websites. It wouldn't make sense to say we're going to require this as a condition of licensing and then not tell them it until the very end that is a condition. So,
true. Representative Call.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And mine's just more of a comment. I wanted to just to share that this weekend when I was reading over this bill in preparation for this week, I was at the same time beginning my bar application that I'm for an exam that I'm going to take a year from now. And there are extreme burdens out there for people who want to enter into a profession to show that they have ethical fitness to enter into that profession. And I think that, you know, this burden is nowhere near that burden, nowhere near as intrusive. And to me, this isn't There are two parts of a licensure of being able to be allowed to enter the profession. One of them is, do you have the skills, the aptitude, the ability to perform the tasks for which you're want to engage, right? And then the other side of that is whether you have whatever ethical criteria are required for entering into that profession, you know. And all of that comes into this. I mean, Representative Berger's example has been the realtor. And, you know, yes, you have to have the skills to be able to enter into that profession. You have to pass the classes and understand what the job is. But also there's an ethical burden that comes along with taking a person and stewarding them into the process in which they're going to assume a great amount of debt and everything else that comes along with owning a home. And to me, this just feels like, you know, on top of being good government and trying to bring people into compliance, but also it feels like an ethical fitness element to the licensure process that I really agree with. And maybe one of the two lawyers can comment on that even more fully. But
Representative Berger.
Please allow me to respond. You know what? Representative Call, I totally agree with you. Lawyers ought to have all those things, okay? But here's who I'm concerned about. Every 3 weeks I sit across from the chair and I get my nails done by a young lady who is fully regulated by the state of Oregon. I don't care whether she does her taxes. I care whether my nails are right, okay? And she is living on the edge right now. And I am very worried about that young woman and her child and her marginally employed husband and adding more barriers to her employment. That's who I'm worried about, not the lawyers.
Thank you. What would be the approach of the department to a person who's coming in from out of state who doesn't have any tax obligations in Oregon because they haven't lived here and is applying for a license as a professional? How would you deal with the compliance issue, that particular compliance issue?
Mr. Chair, if they had no filing requirement, they would be in compliance with the tax laws. So if they simply said, I'm new to the state, I moved here, filed a part-year return, presumably, then they would be in compliance.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you. We appreciate your testimony. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard today on House Bill 3082? Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Sean Jillians representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. I figured since we were the example all morning, probably I should step up here and talk. We do have several concerns with the bill, Mr. Chair, and the first kind of centers around the conversation that you guys just had, which is certainly we expect our members to be ethical and we hold them to the highest standards. Certainly we expect them to pay their taxes. But, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I can tell you some of the emails that I've been getting lately asking for personal loans from our members because they're struggling that bad. They've maxed out their credit cards. They're struggling to stay in their homes if they even own them anymore. They are going through severe, difficult times. Severe, difficult times. Higher than our 10.8% unemployment statewide. And we heard testimony earlier that if you fell behind and you weren't compliant, and you set up a payment schedule, but then you fell behind in those payments, you would be out of compliance. And our members renew every 2 years. And if you're going to take away their ability to make a living, it just seems counterintuitive to me that you expect to get paid back when you take away their ability to make a living. So from the perspective of the realtors, we're very concerned in that regard. The discussion's been very interesting because I feel like I've been brought in so many different angles. I'm also a member of the state bar. And so immediately I went to them and said, well, what do you guys think about this? I mean, can you see the cost of administration? Is that going to be an issue for you? And they said, yeah, actually, we might see that. They have not, by the way, taken an official position. I talked to them this morning. And the second thing I said was, doesn't it seem counterintuitive of taking away a person's ability to make a living? I agree with the background check that we go through. I've actually gone through two of them in two states. They're very intensive. But to say that someone is somehow unethical because they've fallen behind in their taxes in the practice of their profession, I don't think is necessarily all about ethics. It might be severe fiscal distress. The last comment about the nails, I didn't get my nails done, but I did get my hair cut, and some might say not very well, last night. And so I noticed the license up on the wall, and I asked the woman who cuts my hair, hey, what would you feel about this? She's an independent contractor, licensed by the state, and she's required to file quarterly returns. I will not tell you who it was, but she is not up to date on that. And I said, she said, I'm really struggling right now. It's hard for me to get people in my chair. I said, well, how would you feel if the state would not renew your license because of that? And she said, and this is a direct quote, you can't say my name, but you can certainly give my example tomorrow at the hearing. So with that, Mr. Chair, we're certainly not against tax compliance. We think everyone should be tax compliant. We just have serious concerns about the unintended consequences of this bill. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Representative Reed.
Sorry, Representative Bailey.
I'm sorry.
First, I can defer to Representative Bailey. So
Representative Bailey, then Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess a little bit more of a comment. I appreciate your testimony, and I agree that we need to make sure that we have an efficient and well-run system if we implement this. I heard you use the phrase a couple of times, take away the ability of a person to make a living. And I want to make sure that we're making an appropriate distinction here, that asking somebody to follow the law is not taking away somebody's ability to make a living. I think perhaps we might think about on this committee separating the discussion into what the law is and how we ask people to follow the law. And it appears to me that we have perhaps teed up a subsequent conversation for this committee about making sure that we have a progressive tax structure that respects the needs of low-income and working families to be able to continue to make ends meet in these tough financial times. But I would comment that I believe that the laws are on the books for a reason.
Thank you. Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just echo what Representative Bailey is stating. I think that the issue is making sure that we have a progressive tax system, and I hope that the suggestion isn't that your obligation to pay your taxes is the first thing to go by the wayside when hard times come. I mean, it is the law. We do all have an obligation to pay our taxes as responsible citizens of the state of Oregon. So I recognize why people fall on hard times, and this is why people fall behind in rent. It's why people fall behind in mortgages. But again, there are consequences when you're behind on your rent and you're behind on your mortgage, and it seems appropriate that there also should be some consequences if you fall behind on your taxes. Otherwise, we are creating a situation where tax revenues become the first to go away.
Thank you. Yes, you would like to respond to that.
Please. I would, Mr. Chair, and I couldn't agree with both of you more. I do agree that you should have an obligation to pay your taxes, and I'm certainly not advocating that our members stop paying their taxes. But when you're on hard times and you're on a payment schedule and simply falling behind in a payment schedule, I'm sorry, and I probably shouldn't say this on the record as a lawyer up here, but I look at that as a distinction as falling behind rather than a criminal. They've fallen behind on their payments, and so that's the concern that I really have in this one.
Deborah, did you want to add something to this discussion?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Deborah Buchanan with the Department of Revenue. Mr. Chairman, our goal would be to have people talk to us when they fall on those hard times and can't stay current with their pay plan. Tell us that they have the problem. We can restructure pay plans. What we don't want is to have people be on a pay plan, follow those hard times, and then just go silent and not be in compliance and get further and further and further behind and then get scared and not file the next year's tax return or the next year's tax return. We need to get them in and talking to us about what the situation is so that we can work with them on that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Let me just follow up on that. From the way you're describing that, it would seem to me as though you're not interested in getting a licensing board to jerk someone's license who has fallen behind because they don't have any money.
Mr. Chair, we're not. We're not interested in having licenses jerked, period.
And you would consider people in compliance if they come and tell you what their problems are.
If they come and tell us what their problems are and we say, all right, you owe $500 in tax, how much can you pay per month? What can you do to get that current? That's what we want. The point was made that people can't make a living if they don't have these licenses. We understand that. We don't get the revenue unless they're making a living. But as was pointed out, you've put these laws on the books, and we're charged with trying to enforce them and administer them. So what we want to do is tell people, talk to us, tell us what the problems are, and we'll help you get current and stay in the system.
And the people you're going to go after, hammer and tong, are the people that Ms. Maddox was describing as business people who cheat on everything.
Mr. Chairman, I think that would be our primary focus, yes.
Thank you. Representative Reed?
The point has been made. Thank you.
Representative Springer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What do these payment plans look like? So if somebody's not making money, and they're unemployed, so there is no income, and they're behind on probably their mortgage and everything else, is there a matrix you use for these payment plans? I mean, is this something a person can chip in $50 a month and it's going to work? It sounds great to have a payment plan, but if you can't afford anything,
Mr. Chair, Representative Springer, we have staff who do look at that. They look at IRS standards to set up these plans as to what expenses would be taken into account, what the income is. I think a $50 a month payment plan would not be unusual for some people. So we look at what the income is, what the family expenses are, and work with folks on setting those up.
Yes, please.
So then they're in rulemaking, there aren't necessarily standards where it has to be X percent or X amount. Because it's the same in the mortgage industry right now. People with their homes, they need to refinance. You can't refinance when you're unemployed, and they could maybe do less, but they can't do this over here.
Mr. Chair, Representative Springer, we have the ability to restructure payment plans if circumstances change. There are also options to simply settle the amount of tax if someone has demonstrated that they have no income, they're disabled, they have no prospects for future employment, their expenses are such and such. We can simply settle the amount of tax that's owed and just clear the decks. So that's an option also for very extreme cases. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Call.
Trying to pull all of this together for me, because you do have the capacity to pull someone's licensure right now, and the idea license right now, and to your way of thinking, and I think to the way of thinking everybody up here, that what we're trying to do is start the communication earlier in the process to people who are getting licenses about the requirements to be in compliance, that actually we might be doing more good to people who have these licenses, because they would hopefully be told, look, you need to be in compliance, and if you're having troubles, these are the ways you need to go about seeking out information, and you have to be in communication with the Department of Revenue. I mean, if we actually made that part of the licensing process and had that flow of information go out, I mean, it seems to me that this could actually be a benefit to those people instead of a burden, considering the fact that you have the capacity right now to pull someone's license. Do you think that that's accurate?
Mr. Chair, Representative Call, I do think that's accurate. The license suspension is a very, very much after the fact process. The person may be very delinquent in several years of taxes. If you look at the taxes, the interest, and the penalties that have piled up before we get to license suspension, those can be daunting. So, yes, we're looking at this to say, if you want a license to do business in this state or to engage in a profession, and this licensing agency requires tax compliance in order to get that, then you need to know that up front. And if you're not, contact the department and figure out what you need to do to get into compliance. And that may be getting on an installment plan, paying the debt if they can pay it. So, yes, it's upfront work rather than a lot of work at the back end.
Thank you.
Thank you. Please.
One last comment, Mr. Chair, on that point, because that's interesting, Representative Call. What popped into my head when that discussion happened is they already have the authority to revoke licenses if people are seriously delinquent. I think it would be very easy for all the licensing boards to make people more aware at the front end. By the way, the Department of Revenue does have the authority to yank your license if you're not compliant, so make sure that you stay. And I think that wouldn't require a statutory change. It would just require more information up front from the licensing boards.
Thank you. Anything else? Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard this morning on House Bill 3082? Yes, ma'am.
Good morning, Representative Barnhart and members of the committee. My name is Peggy Woolsey. I am retired from the Department of Revenue after 31 years of service. I started out in a clerical position, bottom entry-level clerical. And through the years, I rose through various positions, working in the tax help unit, answering telephone calls all day long, setting up payment plans all day long. I also worked as an administrative specialist, and then before I retired, the prior 6-8 years, I was an auditor. I am speaking not for the Department of Revenue. I'm speaking for myself as a citizen. I'm speaking for my friends and coworkers, former coworkers. When I say that it's very difficult to find a group of people, employees of the state, who are more fiscally conservative than the workers of the Department of Revenue. Many of them in the bottom ranges are being paid so low that they qualify for food stamps and other low-income assistance programs. I myself, when I came to work for the Department of Revenue, was in low-income housing. And all of them are told up front that they must be in compliance to hold that, to get the job and to hold that job. They all recognize that. They all have very strong feelings that it would be fair for everybody else in the state who benefits from any state services to also be in compliance. I also think that this bill mirrors the attitudes and the wishes of my former coworkers. I would also like to say that it's a privilege to be in the state and to work in the state and to benefit from the state services. We should all be in compliance. Thank you very much. Do you have any questions?
Questions? Thank you. We appreciate your testimony.
Certainly.
Is there anyone else on House Bill 3082? Seeing no one, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3082 and open a public hearing on HJR 27, HJR 29, HJR 31, and House Bill 3173.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, these four bills deal with tax expenditures in one way or another. HJR 27 and 29 are nearly identical. They would refer to a constitutional amendment and would require income tax expenditures to be limited as a percentage of revenue to be raised as if the tax expenditures didn't exist. So it's you take the tax expenditure amount, the total income, personal income taxes, divided by total revenue raised through the personal income tax system, and that percentage defines a cap for the total income tax expenditures. So, for example, the bill in 2011 would require personal income tax expenditures to be no more than 42% of personal income tax revenues. And then the bill ramps down the percentage. In 2011, it's 42%. In 2012, it's 39%, and then 36%, and then down to 33% by the time we get to 2014. And for the corporate taxes, those four percentages of 36%, 33%, 30%, and 27%. So that's a way of putting a cap on the total amount of personal income tax expenditures. If that percentage is exceeded, it allows personal income tax rates to be increased for 2 years to offset, to bring that percentage back below the cap. HJR 29 is very similar with slightly different percentages amounts. You have a table in your packet that outlines those. House Bill 3173 sunsets most tax expenditures on January 1, 2014, if no current sunset date exists. It also creates a tax expenditure review commission. HJR 31 specifies that the 3/5 vote requirement for raising revenue contained in Article 4 of Section 25 does not apply to bills that would repeal or suspend the operation of a tax expenditure.
Thank you. Representative Smith, thank you for patiently waiting to be heard. We appreciate your being here this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. My barber doesn't talk to me about licensure requirements. He does, however, tell me conspiracy theories. And for a solid year, he was telling me about how Dick Cheney was responsible for 9/11. The worm has turned, however, and now he is telling me how the income tax has no legal basis. And so I wanted to carry that message to the Revenue Committee from my barber to you.
Thank you, Representative Smith. Yeah. And for the record,
is he going to do a gut and stuff on one of these?
I will. I'm supposed to be in committee now, so I will attempt to be briefer. rather than longer. Tax breaks, expenditures, and loopholes take about 43.5% of the potential general fund. According to Paul Warner, that's about $9.9 billion, is over 50% if you include localities and municipalities. If you include those, that means essentially that we are spending more money in tax break expenditures and loopholes than we are spending on health care and education and public safety combined. In 1995 and 1997, lest we think that that has been a permanent state of affairs, that percentage was not 43.5%. My understanding is that percentage is about 32%. So we've had a significant ratcheting up in just about a decade, and the delta there in those percentages is about $2.5 billion. The reasons for those ratchets are at least two. First, the political challenge of the collective action problem of getting rid of any particular tax break, whereas some just sort of general good government person might want to make sure we were having a balanced approach to how we treated tax expenditures and might not have any particular axe to grind on eliminating any particular one. But the person or the groups who are benefited by that one will go, to use the committee's language, hammer and tongs to preserve theirs. But beyond the political challenge, we also have the challenge that it takes 31 votes to add one, merely 31 votes, simple majority to add one, and 36 votes to subtract one. I bring the bill for two primary reasons. One is to try to persuade the Revenue Committee and people of greater rank than I to think about taking on tax expenditures as a major priority, that it isn't something that comes to us from our friends who are paid advocates for the most part, because many of us have friends and colleagues and clients who benefit from at least one of them. So it's hard to make it a major priority when we're going office to office. But as we're thinking about taking a balanced approach, and I do think that's the direction the legislature is headed, and I had a town hall this weekend, as I know many other members did, and ask the question, if we have a $4 billion, let's say it's a $5 billion, pick your number, gap, do you want to fill that entire gap through service cuts, or would you rather fill that entire gap with revenue increases or with some balance and some combination? And we had everybody debate it, and it was a very mixed crew, including Representative Calls, former opponent John Nelson, including multiple people from the NRA who were there to lobby me on some gun bills that I am supporting, a very diverse range of people. And the consensus in the room, not the majority in the room, the consensus in the room was, with a few outliers saying we should do it all through increased taxes, the consensus in the room was we should have a combination approach. And if we are looking at that, and if we are trying to find places where we are spending money, we're looking for places either to cut or to increase revenue. And it's a good question how you classify a tax expenditure, whether you include it, whether you define it as a tax or expenditure. But either way, we're going to be making hard decisions. So the first reason for bringing these three bills and trying to raise this set of questions is sort of the what else you got to get to a balanced approach. What else you got to have some combination? What else are we going to cut? What else can we consider? This seems like a legitimate thing. And the second is just a good government structural defect concern. If that 32% to 43.5%, and by the way, the last time that Representative Nolan and Representative Roblin brought a bill identical, nearly identical to House Bill 3173 in the 2005 session, that I believe was 40%. If we continue that trajectory, we will very soon be spending much more in tax breaks, expenditures, and loopholes than we are spending in health care, education, and public safety combined. So those are the two reasons I want to bring it. The three proposals I will summarize again briefly. First, and I do think it will take a multiple set of strategies in order to address this in a meaningful way. The first is a cap on the overall outlay. This is just a borrowing of Representative Roblin and Representative Nolan's bill that was an adaptation of a now-Senator Merkley proposal, constitutional referral that would cap the overall outlay of tax breaks as a percentage of the potential general fund. The second would be a sunset and review. I have heard rumor that there are more than one sunset and review proposals out there. There may be others better than anything that I put out. I've heard that there's several. And third, and one maybe I like, or at least is, wasn't something I merely stole, is a simple majority proposal to say at least we should treat the elimination of tax expenditures with the same level of hurdle requirement as the addition of them. Right? So it takes 31 votes to add a tax expenditure, tax break, however we want to call them, should take 31 votes to get rid of them. Those are the three proposals. I offer them in part as placeholders to begin the conversation, but as a subject matter that might warrant a crusade. First, as a part of a balanced budget approach, if we hold these as sacred cows, but we are considering cutting 70 school days, okay, or we are considering raising taxes on working people, and we are not considering making sure we don't ratchet from 32 to 41 to 43.5 to name your top end over the course of our legislative careers, I think we are not having as honest a conversation as we otherwise are, and think that this revenue committee is tasked with perhaps the most challenging set of questions facing the legislature, so I wanted to offer you a few more. And last, because I do think even if we decided not to ratchet it down from 43.5 to get it down to somewhere closer to where it was in 1995-97, but just to try to hold the line a little bit or reduce it a tiny bit so we manage the ratcheting effect, even that I think would be a valuable thing. With that, I will be quiet in case people want to ask questions.
Thank you. Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jefferson, thank you for bringing these bills. This is something I've been fighting about since I thought about running for this office. And one of the things that you said that you have in here is a percentage cap, which I hadn't actually thought of before. I find it interesting, but my thinking has always been we should be giving these tax breaks to projects and people and corporations who actually deserve and need them and will use them for good purpose. And we should not be giving them if that purpose is no longer needed or it's no longer serving that purpose. So how does that fit with percentage of cap?
Good. Thank you. Thank you, Representative Riley. If all we do is sunset and review, I think it is at least as likely as otherwise that what we will receive is a report, and what the legislature will do will say all or almost all of these merit continuation. And that without some mechanism to provide downward pressure, more conversation about tax expenditures might not get us far, and frankly, might not get us anywhere. So that's the first thing I'd say. Second thing I'd say, I think for any interim committee, I think it'd be important for it to be an interim group, and probably not all legislators. And I think you'd want, you know, some certified smart folks as well as certified smart legislators to be thinking about these things. Would not only answer the binary question of this, if this is currently serving the purpose for which it stood, because let's say the purpose for which it stood was the one Mark Hash showed me that it was his favorite in the 2005 session, which was for panning for gold, right? And let's say the purpose of that, the stated purpose, and even the underlying purpose of that was in case someday we were going to have a gold rush, we want to be ready. Well, that purpose still exists. I don't think we're going to have a gold rush soon, but the purpose would still exist. So rather than merely asking the yes or no question of is it still fulfilling its purpose, which could almost always be answered yes, potentially, instead at making us ask and answer a prioritization question, the same way we have to do in the Ways and Means process, say, all right, well, we got all this stuff. What's the most important? Right? And what's the least important and what's in between? And I think you'd want an interim commission that was able to rank those things so that it would aid the committee in making hard choices and then also providing downward pressure so that we actually maybe got somewhere. But I agree with you that, you know, many, I look a lot of those things in books, and I love a lot of that stuff. And, I mean, I'll give one example of something I really like that I also think needs reform, and that's the Betsy. The Betsy is a really positive thing for the state, and it's costing us a lot of money. We might be able to yield almost all of the innovative benefits of the Betsy and with costing less money. But if all we do is have a yes or no question about the Betsy, I mean, that's a challenging political conversation. Right? So we've got to figure out a way to come to grips with this.
Follow up, please. Thank you. And I agree with what you're saying. In your prioritization example, do you see that as just being a prioritization among the expenditures, or do you see that as a prioritization among all things that we spend money on?
It's an excellent question, and one I hadn't considered. I guess I would, the most important answer is I would leave it to the wisdom of the committee, and I say that not merely as a cop-out, but because I really offer all three of these from a humble frame, knowing there's people on this committee who've been thinking about revenue questions far longer than I have. So that's the first and most accurate thing I'd probably say. The second is, my first blush would be, let's talk about tax expenditures, because that's what we're talking about. But if there were some bright way to conflate them, I'd have no, you know, I would certainly personally entertain the notion.
Thank you. Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Smith, I'm one of those who's been sitting on this committee for four terms. And a discussion like this has happened every term.
Very good.
And what usually happens is there's some effort at globalizing this issue, and it comes to naught because these aren't global issues, they're specific issues. And each one, in its own way, needs to be looked at individually. For instance, the Betsy. We have spent a lot of time on the Betsy in this session because it stands out there. You noted it, others noted it, and so we are working hard on the Betsy during this session. Every year, somebody comes up and says gold panning or pig farming or something, but I have yet to see one bill on that tax expenditure. And the reason is it doesn't have fiscal. So I applaud Representative Riley. He looked at that book and said, guts up, I'm going to take on the insurance industry because that's a big one that's hanging out there. And we looked at it. And oh my gosh, poor Representative Riley is now, has arrows sticking out of his back from every insurance agent in my, believe me, I heard from every insurance agency. So I think that those of you who think that this can be globally attacked better realize that this is every one of these means something to somebody, and if there's a bunch of little ones to get rid of, fine, bring me the list, gold panning, out, but those are not the issue. The issue are the big ones, and they cannot, in my opinion, be globally addressed. They need to be individually talked about and individually billed out, as Representative Riley tried to do with one of the big ones. Otherwise, I mean, your numbers about the amount of expenditures, most of those in dollar amounts are big ones that we've never talked about.
Exactly.
And you know what they are, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So, what we sell to the public is we're just giving away money. Well, who are we giving it away to? We're giving it to you, the public, is who we're giving the most of the big ones of. And that conversation never really comes out in the public sphere when you talk about these things. What we mostly talk about, oh, we're giving it away business. Well, we are giving some to business, but the big ones, they aren't going to business. They're going to taxpayers. And believe me, we never want to whack those back without great political danger, and they never come up. So I've had this conversation. Oh, I'm getting jaded, Representative Smith, and I'm sorry for that because I have heard all this way too many times, and yet I have never seen anybody come forward with a let's ban the tax expenditure on gold panning bill.
Thank you, Representative Berger, and I hope to be a breath of fresh air in your otherwise jaded legislative career as you move forward. It gets brighter and brighter. I hope to reinvigorate the passion.
One more comment before we get started. One of the great advantages of this is I was just reading about you online, and I want you to go and read it, and I complimented you, I think.
All right. My own view is that an approach to have any hope, and I realize this is a challenging deal, and I think it's, you know, I mean, to pass women's suffrage in this state, we had to not only have 4 session conversations, we had to go to the ballot 4 times. It might have been 5 in order to pass women's suffrage. I mean, I think the hard stuff, if we think it happens in the first conversation, we are misunderstanding the necessity of political courage and difficulty and challenge in doing hard things. This is hard, right? This is a really hard deal.
And only men got to vote on it.
Which made it harder.
But they had wives.
For me, in order to address this in any honest, legitimate, and hopefully successful way, it will have to be, both global and individual. I will use your own examples to suggest that that is exactly why I think we need some global as well as individual attention. Nobody is, I mean, the lesson of Representative Riley is not, hey, yay, let's all go forth and find our least favorite one and go after it. The lesson of Representative Riley is that's a really challenging thing that you can only, you know, each person might be able to figure out their favorite one, and if they prioritize that over all of their other bill priorities, they might be able to win, right? And that means they wouldn't be doing stuff on some other piece of public safety legislation they wanted or some other piece of legislation that I've been hearing from members of the committee. So we've got to have, I think, some global approach as well as an individual approach. But in that, I don't think it would be a global approach at the expense of or the elimination of an individual approach any more than our ways and means process is over how we spend money and just spend money. And in our efforts to move towards priority-based budgeting, which I think is a critical priority for governance in our state, there will still be, after you make any priority listing, large, major, big conversations about every line item that falls under any imaginary dotted line, right? So I don't imagine we'll ever set aside the individual conversation. I also have no hope that any progress will be made if all we have is individual conversations.
Yeah, Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since my name seems to be
used in vain,
come up a bit. I want to point out that, yes, I've been trying to do this very thing since 2005, and this term I decided to get some attention.
Yes, you did.
And it worked.
I see the arrows.
Yeah, it worked.
I got some attention, too.
Yeah, but the point being that if we try to do this on an individual basis, it will never work. And the reason it will never work is every individual expenditure out there has a constituency. And that constituency will be in here in mass and shooting arrows. And whoever the person who brings it, the opposing party will also be throwing arrows and slings. And and so you're going to be stuck. What we really need, and I applaud you because I think this is right, we really need an interim committee to consider and to prioritize and to make sure that we're looking at all the expenditures and we're looking at them in relationship to our other expenditures, not just tax expenditures. And the only way to do that is it globally, because individually it will not work.
That's true.
Yeah, Representative.
Sure. The problem, and this is more of a comment, the problem with the global aspect is that it's not until you get to the individual effort, as Representative Riley, so that you truly understand and know the effect of the tax expenditure on the general public. And we heard loud and clear that particular one, that insurance model, affected people's livelihoods. It affected, it was clear in my mind that it didn't make sense. But that's how it bubbled to the surface rather than the global effect. We're not going to get that feel in the global effect. So I nominate Representative Riley to keep going down the path of these individually until we find one. Until we find one that has no constituency, and then let's get rid of it. So.
And may I?
Please. I think you have to.
Yeah. I believe that, you know, the global approach actually is an individual approach to all tax expenditures. What would happen is, in the interim, all of these issues would come up one at a time. The constituencies would come, say, here's why. The people who would say they're not good would come and say, here's why not. We would be looking at them individually, but not during session, because we don't have the time to do this on every bill during session. And I just can't see any other way, and I'm really, obviously a proponent of getting a committee, interim committee, or as this representative has said, a commission, to present an omnibus bill to the Revenue Committee on tax expenditures.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Call.
Yeah, I'd just like to, I'm like Representative Smith, I'm in my first session, and I tell you, I guess, just from my vantage, sitting on Revenue and sitting on a Ways and Means Subcommittee, there's two things that happen that I feel like are quite different from each other. And Representative Shields in the Public Safety Sub always says that it's a zero-sum game, which is the idea that if we're going to, right now, if we're going to fund one thing, it means we're going to take funds away from something else. And the discussions that we've had with regards to tax credits don't have that same zero-sum component. The two that we've really spent a bit of time on this session is expanding the EITC and potentially reforming the Betsy. But there's never a discussion, or there hasn't been thus far, about how those two things relate. How globally, when you're looking at tax credits, how potentially you could take some funds from one tax credit and hand it over to another to great benefit to one group and to great, maybe potential harm to another group. Those are the discussions that are had in Ways and Means that I think people would like to have happen here. And to the extent that we have that kind of zero-sum discussion where we're forced to create winners and losers in the tax expenditure process the same way we are in the Ways and Means process, I think illustrates the importance or why it's necessary to look at this globally. Because right now, I feel like with regards to tax expenditures, there's no zero budgeting process. There's no looking out and saying, at some point, we can't go any further with this, or we have to balance the interests of this against the interests of that. I just don't feel like that is happening, and which is why I think moving individually, looking at them individually, if you look at the merits of one tax credit individually, and don't look at it in relation to all the other tax credits or tax expenditures, I think you lose sight of the real importance of the global framework. So those are my two cents.
Thank you. Unless there's some specific questions for Representative Jefferson Smith, I'd like to go on to the other witnesses.
May I have one moment
just
to respond to the last few comments?
Yeah.
Appreciate very much, members of the committee. The conversation you're having right now is the conversation I think that we are hoping to prompt. Let me offer just a few thoughts. First, and was hoping Representative Berger would be here to hear this, but very carefully in my opening remarks, tried to avoid any attacking of any particular, not until I answered questions, any particular tax break or any particular sector that I thought is benefit. I mean, there's no sort of anti-business deal. I mean, most of this is personal stuff, right? Personal income tax stuff. I think this is a structural challenge and should be viewed as such rather than a political football or partisan challenge or name your favorite constituency challenge.
Okay.
The second is, and with response to you, Representative Brune, I think you make an excellent point about we need to have an individual analysis of these things. And so I guess maybe the way that we could see this that might help get closer to consensus is that what I think I and maybe others are proposing might be viewed as a systemic change in how we have that individual conversation, right? Not saying we are going to blindly take a lathe and cut somewhere, but that we are right now don't have the structural mechanisms so that the public conversation can yield the public interest in this realm. And then last, let me say, there are other ways of doing this, and one of them, Representative Gelser mentioned to me, or maybe it was somebody else, if she wants to not be the one who mentioned it, some mythical person mentioned to me that another way of doing this would be to, instead of capping the overall outlay of the state, doing it on an individual taxpayer, and you only get a certain percentage of your potential, so there's a couple different mechanisms to address this. And the very, very last thing I would say is my guess is it's going to take more than one mechanism to get there. You know, in a robust conversation and more than one good mechanism. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you very much. Kathy Eaton and Marcia Kelly. Kathy, it's great to see you this morning. And Kathy Eaton has signed up on the three House joint resolutions. Marcia Kelly has signed up on HJR 31. Please.
Morning, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. This has been a fascinating discussion. And thank you for the opportunity to comment on 27, 29, 31, and 3173 altogether. That makes a great deal of sense. The League for the last four sessions has been around being very much interested in doing something about...
Now, of course, I know what League you're referring to, but would you go ahead and give us the full name?
I beg your pardon. I should have remembered.
And identify yourself. Thank you.
For the record, my name is Kathy Eaton. I'm the Governance Coordinator for the League of Women Voters of Oregon.
Thank you.
And we're appreciative of the ability to comment on all of these 27, 29, 31, and 3173 this morning for some time, but as mentioned, for the last four sessions of the legislature, we have supported proposals to limit the state's expenditures, its tax expenditures. The more than $27 billion in possible revenue that the state literally gives away every biennium cannot be defended in poor economic times such as today. That being said, the League has two specific concerns with regard to HJRs 27 and 29. In analyzing the revenues that might be obtained, careful consideration must be made regarding the nature of each affected expenditure so that the important social and economic goals for which they were put in place is not lost. The measures paint with a broad brush. We don't pretend to look at the specifics with the analysis of the percentages that would be taken from over the life of the bills, but we are concerned that there be an excellent examination of what is accomplished by these bills, and we think that there is another issue that we wanted to bring up, and that is the League very rarely supports putting what we consider statutory material into the Constitution. The specific percentages and the years of implementation certainly are critical to the outcome of the limits. But putting them in the Constitution limits the flexibility of the legislature for revisions that could be necessary, even with the allowing of the legislative reviews that is mentioned in the bills. The ability of the legislature to temporarily raise income tax rates in the Constitution, as provided in lines 19 through 28, is equally troubling. This has been a very interesting conversation this morning. And both sides, I think, have come to fore because we've heard the arguments over the last four sessions that this is something that simply can't be done. It needs to be done, but it can't be done because you've got all of the people that are come in and say, no, not in my area. Do it in somebody else's area. Maybe it should be done, but don't do it to me. And I think that's got to, we have to put that aside. And however you can determine to do that, it's very important that it be done. It's time to look at and to stop the bleeding that's occurring. We are in a situation where we give away, as Representative Smith said, almost 50% of our general fund, or what could be our general fund. And looking at the services which the state is now unable to provide, we think it's very important that you really take seriously how you can look at revenue to provide the services which the people in the state need. And one of the ways to do that is to bite the bullet and take a look at these tax expenditures, however you finally decide as a mechanism to do that. And I think Representative Smith's last comment that this is a structural challenge, I think that's very well put. I think it is a structural challenge. But we urge you to really seriously get down to business with this. We've discussed it since 2003 and even before that. But something needs to be done, and I think we look to you to start that discussion and to move it forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Please.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Marcia Kelly, and I'm a member of the American Association of University Women of Oregon's Public Policy Committee. And I speak in favor of the HJR 31, which would simply change the questionable requirement of whether three-fifths is needed to take away a tax expenditure or a tax exception. If it can go in with 31, it should be able to come out with 31. It only makes sense. And I would further urge you to not only look at tax expenditures that affect the general fund of the state of Oregon, the corporate and personal income taxes, but also to look at tax expenditures that affect the ability of local governments to collect full property taxes. Local governments are a part of how we can get Oregon out of the situation that it is in. Local governments are where the services meet the road in many, many ways. And every local government that I know in our area is struggling with not being able to provide the services that we are constitutionally and required to provide because of some of those limitations. So it's not just the state general fund that needs to be looked at. It also needs to be the property tax system and the exceptions that we make for unknown economic resources coming back.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Yes, Representative Riley.
Thank you. Your point about the local expenditures is well taken, which is why I always recommend that we look at the entire tax expenditure book and not just the state-imposed income tax credits. So,
and Chair Barnhart, Representative Riley, that's exactly what I've been trying to follow in a part-time basis, unpaid volunteer, is watching some of the things that are supposed to have economic effect and then not really having measurable ways of counting that economic effect or having a program or a outline on how it's going to actually provide those numbers of jobs and they're actually going to be those personal jobs. And the other thing to look at is urban renewal districts and length of time for urban renewal districts.
Different topic, I think.
Yeah, different.
Other questions for this panel? I think that you're suggesting that HJR 31 would need at least an amendment that would allow for the definition of tax expenditure to not only the state taxes imposed are measured by income, but also local taxes measured by property values or property in some way.
In a perfect world.
As part of the definition of tax expenditure.
In a perfect world, that would be good.
Thank you. Other questions for this panel?
I'll take it the way it is. If you can't get the amendment, I'd take it the other way, Chair
Barnhart. Representative Barnhart, could I make one more comment?
Yes, please.
Marcia reminded me that the League did want to specifically say with regard to HJR 31 that it's time to go to the simple majority for these kinds of measures.
Thank you. You know, it's pretty clear as we were having the conversation with Representative Jefferson Smith that there are several different levels at which you can look at the structural issues. And we haven't been very explicit about that yet today. And I think 31 is probably the clearest way of getting at one way of describing this problem, and that is the asymmetric way in which we adopt or and repeal tax credits. The other approach we're working on, of course, is the one that has to do with sunsets, which the result of which would be that in order to keep the tax credit or tax expenditure, you would have to adopt it again by a majority vote, even with the current bifurcated rule. Then the other issue, which we haven't talked about at all, is how we do comparisons between tax expenditures in the revenue side and budget expenditures on the ways and means side, because as we were describing earlier, we're talking about the two ends of the building, and they don't get together very easily, very often. That's a different kind of problem, perhaps, but I don't think that, to my knowledge, no one does a systematic job of comparing tax expenditures, which, after all, are expenditures of the state,
yeah,
with the budget and the budget expenditures and the budget priorities. I think that doing that might be rather enlightening. There are many things that we think of as absolutely sacrosanct in the revenue side of things that might pale when compared to cutting school days, not taking care of the sick, or other things that the ways and means side of the building is facing at the current time. I don't expect you to respond to that unless you want to, but
I would like,
please,
Kathy and Chair Barnhart. This is a conversation that we have often away from the Capitol in other groups, is to say, why in the world aren't you talking to each other? Why in the world aren't you having joint meetings? Because the two have got to mesh in order to solve the problem, and we don't see that. We applaud you when there are joint meetings of the two revenue committees, when there are joint meetings of the two rules committees, but certainly revenue and ways and means needs to get together in a much more less formal and could be incredibly productive way to do things.
Thank you.
Chair Barnhart, I would also like to address that. I think it's not only just the revenue committees and the ways and means committees, but I would propose that all legislators need to sit through all of the information that revenue gets at the very beginning of the session on where money comes from, where money goes, so that everyone in the building who is making decisions on spending money understands where it comes from.
Thank you. I was looking to see if I was getting a smile from Paul Werner. I didn't until just now.
I've been through this. This is the first session I haven't sat through all of those orientation meetings when presented to the Revenue Committee out of five sessions. So,
thank you. Anything else? Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard on these resolutions and the bill? Not seeing anyone, we'll close the public hearing. Colleagues, we have one bill that we have not gotten to today, and my proposal is that we hold the public hearing on House Bill 3203 over until tomorrow. And so have I given the notice required? I have, and so that bill will be held over until tomorrow, and the committee is adjourned. Thank you.